There's way too much at stake to not do it. And as a result, you see an enormous amount of effort being put into getting it right by all parties. Unrealistic time frames for accomplishing goals are something that we as an industry are concerned about. Limiting industries from using market mechanisms to their fullest extent is a concern, and we hope not a recipe for disaster. But I think the potential is there, and one of the things that we've looked at as an industry that has been regulated for many, many, many years, don't pick winners and losers. Probably sounds trite, but I think it's really important that both the regulators and the regulated community keep that in mind. This chart will be up here while I'm speaking. It's one of my favorites. I call it the New Jersey reality check. Before people get too enamored of any future, interesting to note that this chart was prepared by the Energy Information Administration, EIA, and it's their annual energy outlook. This happens to be 2009's fourth try. It's instructive, I think, if you add up the numbers while I'm speaking, because I'm not going to focus on the chart other than speak about it at the moment. In 2008, the makeup of energy supplies to meet demand in the U.S., all forms of energy, was almost 85% fossil fuels and 15% renewables, hydro, biomass, and other renewables, and nuclear. The same government that is forecasting great changes in improving technology and use of all kinds of alternative and renewable fuels as we address climate change issues, same government is forecasting in 2035, based on a perspective of a 14% increase in U.S. demand for energy, that fossil fuels will make up almost 80%, not 85 anymore, but almost 80%. Of that which satisfies our demand, and renewables and alternatives a little over 20. So I think it's something to keep in mind. It is a reality check. It bears revisiting. And one of the important things that we think about as an industry is that, I mentioned earlier, California going it alone. One of the things we have to look out for is that we don't want to create a competitive disadvantage for California, whether that's to other states. And for an industry like our refining industry, it certainly relates to other countries, where if our industry, based on regulation, finds it more and more difficult to operate in this and other states, our choice to meet ongoing demand is foreign imports. That's not a happy thought from two perspectives. One, foreign imports traditionally bear a higher price at the margin, import parity. That's not great for consumers. The second thing is, the operations overseas are not controlled and regulated to the same degree of environmental reliability as here in the United States. So, again, just a few things to keep in mind. We're going to need all the fuels that we can get our hands on for the future, regardless of how we ultimately address climate change. As an industry, we've not simply said, no, we're not going to participate. Quite the opposite. Many of our members are heavily invested in alternative and renewable fuels. But we do have an idea of how to deal with the issue going forward, and it's something we call Petroleum Plus. And I'm sure you're sitting there thinking, now, why would the petroleum guy use a title like that? Well, it is our business. It's core to our members. But let me explain what we mean. We're looking at making good use and continued use and extended use of all of the petroleum products that we have managed to make cleaner and cleaner over the years, and that we'll continue to make cleaner, particularly from a criteria pollutant standpoint, and augment those fuels with any and all renewables and alternatives, and you can recite the list of them as well or better than I can, but they really need to meet certain tests. One is that they need to be scientifically sound. They have to work. They also need to be technologically feasible. By that, I mean they have to be at scale. They have to be commercially viable in quantities that will help us make a transition from full carbon fuels to fuels of the future that have lower carbon content. And finally, they have to be cost effective. That's a consumer issue. It's an industry issue. It's an economy issue. It's even an unemployment issue when you get down to looking at industries that may be affected by our rules and regulations. One of the things we have to keep in mind is that There is a risk for economic disruption and dislocation, and both regulators and companies investing in our future have to keep that in mind. We're still going to need, at the end of the day, the kind of jobs that are currently created, maintained, and expanded by all of the regulated industries, not just petroleum, refining, and production, but power generators and cement manufacturers and other targeted industries under AB 32. We've lost 800,000 manufacturing jobs since 2000, according to the Milken Institute and CMTA. That number is just for California. It's a big deal. Those are typically high-paying jobs, and we want to make sure that we don't lose more of them. This issue of reducing carbon content and addressing climate change is complicated, particularly in the fuels area, because there are many layers. There's technology, there's the fuels, there are the vehicles that consume the fuels, there are the delivery systems for the fuels and the dispensing systems at locations where consumers can access current and future fuels, and all of that has to be addressed. We think that maybe some of the projections for vehicles and fuel availability in the future may be a little optimistic, and that gets back to what I just mentioned, an area that was mentioned in the earlier panel that doesn't always see a lot of the limelight is infrastructure. For every single new fuel of the future, there has to be not just a little infrastructure, but a robust one. It has to be able to deliver fuels so that consumers can drive from A to B, heat and cool their homes, do all the things they do today, and do it with a sense of comfort that allows them to support the kind of effort that is being undertaken. And I don't think there's any way to undersell that, the importance of that. Finally, I think one of the things that's been lacking within industry and between industry and government is a more robust dialogue among all the parties. Sometimes individual industries tend to go their own way and talk about their issues and things they can or can't accomplish, and I think we need to expand the dialogue so that the fuel manufacturers, the folks who are developing new technology, the providers of vehicles who will use the fuels of the future need to have a much more robust dialogue with government and ensure that we're all on the same page because, as I said before, this is too big an issue for us to miss. We have to get it right. Let me close by bringing it close to home to something that the Bay Planning folks have been involved with and that I've actually spoken on in previous conferences, and that is something as straightforward, as my friend Mark Bayer's in the back, he'll smile, as straightforward as dredging has a environmental impact. And it's important that we keep in mind when folks like us go out and look for ways to improve and maintain dredging, that's an environmental issue. If we dredge properly, if we keep the channels at the required depth, particularly for petroleum fuels, we will have less tanker transit. We'll have less emissions. We'll have less, potentially, trucks on the road carrying material from A to B and fewer lighterings. And all those things contribute to better environmental controls. So I'll leave you with that close-to-home example and step aside for the next individual.
Thanks, Joe. I'd like to now introduce Richard Sinkoff, who is the Director of the Division of Environmental Programs and Planning for the Port of Oakland. Richard.
Okay, good morning. And I feel like I'm looking out on an audience of all my friends. So I've worked with most of you, many of you, either at the Port of Oakland or in an interagency capacity. So I think that was the intent of this conference, which was to put us all together and identify strategies and solutions to this huge problem. Let me start off by saying just a few things. First, I entitled my single slide, building an effective strategy at the Port of Oakland, because I think as an industry, the port is very interested in understanding the magnitude of the problem as it affects both our seaport and our airport, and then coming up with very discrete actions that can address the problem. And that essentially is what a strategy is. So what I will do is I'm just going to talk about actually efforts that are underway at the Port of Oakland. Many of them are in partnership with many of you or other groups, agencies, and see whether we can come up with additional ideas about how to really develop an effective carbon management strategy. So the first thing, just as a context setting, I think climate change is very different from the kind of environmental issues that we've faced previously. It's probably the most complex because, unlike other development or operations that the port might be involved in, this is a problem where external climate change issues are going to have an effect upon the port, and then there are operations and activities that the port undertakes that have an effect on climate change. So we actually, as an organization, we have to look both at the effects of climate change on port facilities, on port operations, on our markets, and also look at our operations and the emissions that result from our operations or from the operations of our customers on the climate change issue. So a strategy really has to first understand the scope of the effort, the scope of the problem itself. And some of the, I'll just mention some of the effects on the port that we are starting to think about. Sea level rise. The rising level in the bay will have an effect on our airport, certainly. South Field was created on landfill in San Francisco Bay. We are currently working on a South Field perimeter dike study to understand how high we have to build that dike to protect the airport that I'm sure all of you use on a very frequent basis, and also our maritime facilities. Could be potentially affected by sea level rise. We're also thinking about perhaps the effects on our markets. The port is a tremendous gateway for exports coming out of the Central Valley, and climate change could potentially have an effect on agriculture, water use. So there are issues there for us as well. Of course, there are regulations. I'll talk about those. CEQA, and a big effect on the Port of Oakland, is the financial impact of addressing climate change. On the impact side that we potentially need to look at, of course, our operations, the operations of our carriers, of our terminals, of our airport, have an effect on emissions. And we also have, the Port of Oakland itself has a relatively small plant and fleet. We also have buildings, facilities. All of those have an effect on this issue of climate change. So the first thing we have to do is we have to spend quite a bit of time, which we're doing right now, understanding the scope of the problem and consulting. There's a great deal of work that we're doing right now, consulting with stakeholders. And I'll just mention a few, and we'll have a follow-up discussion about this perhaps later. Climate change discussions are happening at the local, state, regional, local, regional, state, federal, and international level. It really cuts vertically. And at every one of those levels, there are groups working on strategies for climate change. So here in the city of Oakland, we have the Oakland Climate Action Coalition, which is working on an energy and climate action plan. Of course, regionally, we've touched on those today. There are all the federal laws that we have to deal with. And because our industries are international in scope, we also have to look at what's happening at the UN level, at the International Maritime Organization, and also on the aviation side with the International Aviation Trade Association. So there's a lot, there's a large scope here. But I think consultation is critical to determine strategies at each one of those levels. In terms of goals, all of us know there are many different standards that are being proposed or set. AB 32 has its standards, but there are also local standards, and the federal government is establishing its standards as well. So the question is, how do you develop an effective climate strategy, climate change strategy, to address all those different standards? How do you reconcile that? And is it even possible to do that? Identifying practicable actions, well, that's, I hope, the key of our discussion today. Obviously, the state is starting to develop some of those actions. We've already developed many of them. For those of you who are in the trenches with us on our Maritime Air Quality Improvement Plan, which the board of the port adopted last year in April, so a year ago, we've already started to implement the projects and programs under that plan, which will have co-benefits. And those are our truck program, our comprehensive truck management program. We're now designing our shore power program. We had an earlier program under the Vision 2000 development. We have numerous programs at Oakland International Airport that are actually building a climate change strategy, such as preconditioned air, where we're building a new apron, which will have plug-in capacity for all of our aircraft. And additionally, we have a solar project. So there's a lot going on, but I think we need to go further to address what Henry said. We're also looking at early action and actions that go above and beyond what's required. Well, scope and secure resources. This is a critical issue, I think, for all of us. I'd like to hear a lot about it today because in this new era where we've reset the fiscal button, resources are scarce. I think we need to pool resources. And it may not just be financial. It's intellectual resources. It's collaborative resources. It's community resources. So let's think broadly about that issue. Setting a planning milestone, of course, is critical for a strategy. You have to know where you want to be by a certain point in time. Under our MACWIP, we have two planning horizons, 2012 and 2020. The state, of course, has a 2020 goal, but there are also proposals at the federal level that I'm aware of for a 2050 goal. So again, building a strategy has to take into account where you want to be over time and what is feasible. And then, of course, implementing the strategy, all of those actions will be a critical step, measuring it and then reviewing and adjusting. So where are we today? Right now, the Port of Oakland is building on the platform of the projects that we've implemented that I discussed earlier. We're in dialogue with many of the stakeholders. We're trying to get a sense of the magnitude of the problem, what we can effectively do. And one thing I'd like to point out, the Port of Oakland itself does not own and operate most of the equipment that generates emissions in our transportation sector. That is the shipping, the carriers, the shipping lines, and the aircraft. So the question is, what role do ports play in all of this? And I think one of the key roles that we play is to develop the strategies, bring together the stakeholders, and influence good decision making. So with that, I'll leave you, and I look forward to your questions later on.
Thank you, Richard. Our next speaker is Scott Moore with Union Pacific Railroad. Scott.
Don't change that slide yet. Keep it right there. Why is a railroad guy here? Well, to help do that, I need some help from you. First off, those of you in the front row, look at your watch. I got 300 seconds. If I go over, stand up so I sit down, because that's my goal, to stint within the 5 minutes. You know, also for all of you now, I say railroads. What comes to mind in your mind? How many say Satan? Oh, good group here. How many think of the octopus in the history there? Now, when I say trains, what comes to mind? Probably a passenger train comes to mind. Or maybe if you're a certain age, you think of Uncle Joe at Petticoat Junction, the old number 9, going to Pixley, just steaming away. Well, you know, I'm here to get a couple of those things out of your mind. I mean, this is not all Uncle Joe's railroad. This is not your grandfather's railroad. Now, ignore that it says I'm from Union Pacific Railroad. And I'm here today to say that there's a technology that can move 40% of the freight of this country and only generate 2% of the greenhouse gases. There's a technology that everybody knows out there that only generates 2% of the transportation greenhouse gases in the state of California. There's a technology in the last 25 years that has increased fuel efficiency by 94%. There's a technology that fuel efficiency today is the equivalent of getting 300 or 400 miles per gallon in your SUV. There's a technology out there that if you would, that 40% freight that I talked about, if you were to transfer 10%, an additional 10% of that technology, you'd save 1 billion gallons of fuel a year. 1 billion gallons of fuel a year. Once again, I am from the railroad. All those things are true. And actually, the policy we're going after probably doesn't increase moving freight by rail by 10%, but the policy that our country and others are on probably is going to decrease going forward the amount of freight moved by rail. And so that's why I'm here. Now go to my first slide. And anybody that's negotiated with the railroad knows the railroad is impossible to negotiate with. And I negotiated 2 slides. And so I admit that right now. But you have to understand, but I promised I'd be in 300 seconds, and I better hurry up. Where's Oakland? Well, Oakland in Union Pacific in the 23 states is key. It's the shortest distance from the western ports of Chicago where the bulk of the freight goes. Also, where's Oakland? You know, we call it our I-5 corridor, which is actually over in Sacramento. But two things our company's done privately is raise the tunnel clearances in the Cascades, raise the tunnel clearances in the Donner Pass in the last four or five years. A double stack train could take 300 trucks off the interstate. That was done with private dollars to find, you know, because it made sense for us. I-5 service started last year for the first time in about 20 years, actually is truck competitive. So that's where Oakland in the Bay Area fits in the UP system. My second slide, if I may, please. Once again, words don't work well for me, pictures do. You know, what is the UP network in the Bay Area? And it's, you know, and more importantly, that passenger train thing I mentioned about, you know, there are 70 passenger trains a day in the Bay Area moving on Union Pacific, yet Union Pacific is known to be impossible to negotiate and not passenger friendly. But the fact of the matter is, you know, there's 3 major ways, Oakland to Martinez to Sacramento. 44 passenger trains a day are going from Oakland to Martinez to the point that in 2007, when things were going great at the Port of Oakland, we were limited, getting limited almost to the amount of freight we could push out of here. Same thing, Oakland down to Niles Junction over to Lathrop is the Alameda Corridor. Excuse me, not the Alameda Corridor, wrong side of the state. The Altamont Corridor Express passenger trains, another way for Union Pacific trains to move out. There's a line from Martinez over to Lathrop that everybody thinks abandoned. Actually, is a rail line that was for sale years ago. People thought it was worth too much. It's no longer for sale. All my points in all this is that, once again, freight and freight rail can play a key role in impacting in the environment. You know, it's one of those things where people think it was an 18th or 17th century technology. Well, I submit to you, and I better sit down, it's a 21st century solution to a 21st century problem, and we can talk more in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. I'd now like to introduce Lisa Swanson, our next speaker, who is Director of Environmental Affairs for Matson Navigation Company. Lisa.
Okay. I got the graphics off this slide from one that we normally use to talk about the history of Matson. But when I saw it, it really struck me that when Captain Matson made his first commercial voyage in 1882 from San Francisco to Hilo, he had 0 carbon footprint. We're now in the age of the modern container ship. And currently, according to International Maritime Organization, IMO study, that came out in 2009 and is included on your CD. International shipping emitted approximately 2.7% of global emissions of carbon dioxide. So we're not considered a major contributor, but of course we all have to do our part as well. As my counterpart just mentioned about rail, ocean shipping is also a very efficient method of moving goods around the country. And even ocean shipping compared to trucking and rail, again, there's some really good data in that IMO report, but often we see an order of magnitude increase in carbon efficiency for ocean transportation. International shipping is not currently regulated under the state and federal climate change regulations that have been passed in terms of reporting and the proposed cap and trade programs that are being proposed in California. But, sorry, I lost my train of thought here. But at the United Nations conference in Copenhagen in December, the IMO did put forth that they feel they are the best organization to regulate ocean transportation and climate change impacts. And the Marine Environment Protection Agency of the IMO has made some really good progress in terms of improving the energy efficiency of the global fleet, as well as coming up with the associated funding mechanisms. And they had a meeting end of March where they furthered their progress in that area. For new ships, there's a number of things that can be done to improve energy efficiency. One of the most important considerations is the service of the vessel. Typically, the larger your ship is, the more energy efficient it is because it can transport more cargo. But that only holds true if you can fill the ships. And so Matson is actually going through a new build program right now where we are very carefully looking at our service and trying to decide the size of our ships and whether we want ro-ro capacity or all container ships along those lines. So those are very important considerations. There are also design features related to the hull and the propeller where you can see some increased efficiency. Regarding alternative fuels, a lot of companies are starting to look at biofuels, but they currently pose a lot of technical challenges for use in ships just because of their chemical properties. Also, there's still relatively limited availability, and the cost is quite high. Liquid natural gas, LNG, may become more attractive in the future, especially in certain areas where that availability is not an issue. Unfortunately, world commerce does not allow us to go back to the days of sailing ships, but there is maybe some use of wind and solar power in modern container ships, but we won't be able to rely on that entirely. At most, it will be a partial source of replacement power. Regarding existing vessels, there's things that we are starting to do as well there. And there's been a lot of talk in the news about slow steaming. And that's where just like when you drive your car slower, you get more fuel efficiency. We can slow down our ships and improve our fuel efficiency as well. For Matson, that poses some additional challenges. We are a U.S. flag carrier, and we also have a very small fleet. We're currently running 9 ships. So we do a lot of short transits between domestic ports, and our schedule just does not allow for us to do a lot of slowing down of our ships, and would probably take introducing another ship into service, and you know, so when you start getting into that situation, also if you have to speed up in other legs of your voyage, some of those efficiencies that you've gained through slowing down are eliminated. The other thing existing vessels can do is keep up with your hull cleaning. And when our ships have been going to dry dock, we have had very good success with the use of some of the new super sleek silicone-based hull coatings. And those increase your fuel efficiency. And they also have the additional benefit of inhibiting growth and hopefully preventing introductions of potentially invasive species. And then I just wanted to mention as well, Richard had mentioned shore power, and that is really the one item that's included currently under the AB 32 scoping plan as a climate change initiative for our industry. To some people, it seems a bit counterintuitive because electric and heat production does account for more than one-third of the global greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, they're a very large source, so we're talking about basically needing increased electricity usage in order to have our engines shut down their engines in port. Originally, the shore power concept, CARB adopted their regulation to address the health effects related to port air quality. But they do have studies, I think, through the use of alternative power sources to create electricity, that it still can be counted as a climate change initiative. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Our last panelist before we get to the question and answer session is Paul Campos. Paul is Senior Vice President and General Counsel for BIA of the Bay Area, formerly Home Builders Association of Northern California.
Thank you, and thank you all for having me here. I think I'm going to be in really big trouble with my builder members because I had planned to spend exactly 0 seconds of my talk talking about the energy efficiency of new housing and what we do from a building perspective. But I will throw that in there, that new housing in California is the most energy efficient and has the smallest greenhouse gas threshold and footprint in the United States. So. You can tell my builders I said that. My remarks are going to be focused on regulation. And the slide that I was allotted is a markup that I have done of an excerpt from one of the leading CEQA treatises that we have in California. CEQA, of course, being the California Environmental Quality Act. And this particular excerpt talks about one of the core components of CEQA, and that's the cumulative impact analysis. Cumulative impacts, for those of you who aren't CEQA geeks like me, refer to the part of CEQA that seeks to prevent the death to the environment by 1,000 cuts. In other words, if you just look at the impacts of a development project in isolation, And don't take a look at all other development projects in the area and their related impacts and how they combine and interact, you lose the big picture. And you don't see the combined cumulative impact on the environment and the contribution of individual projects to that. And I would argue that here in the Bay Area, we have not done a good job of doing a similar analysis with respect to the cumulative impact of regulation on business and on my industry, new housing projects. And I thought it might be instructive to sort of flip it around and see what it might look like if we had a statute in California that required an assessment of cumulative impacts of regulations on the economy. And that's, you know, there, some people are laughing, but that's actually, the U.S. is a bit behind in this. Canada and the United Kingdom are really exploring the issue of regulatory impact assessment to a much greater degree than we are, and are moving along these lines. I only realized at the end I shouldn't have crossed out CEQA, because that could be the California Economic Quality Act, so get out of there. But when I talk about the need for cumulative impact analysis of regulation, I think that really there are two prongs to that. One is cost, and the other is policy. Each of our, and I'm going to sort of pick on the regional agency folks because I've been dealing with them a lot, and they're great. I love them. But each of them implement and operate under a principal single statute, and they are constrained, whether they like it or not, by the laws that they implement in what they can look at. For example, although they're not here, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is prohibited by the Endangered Species Act from considering the economic impacts of listing a particular species. They couldn't if they wanted to. Yet there are tremendous costs associated with listing a species. Other agencies, for example, the Water District, when they are adopting their MS4 permits, are allowed to take into consideration economic impacts to regulated activities, but only of their particular regulatory program. So you will inevitably get the response, well, our new regulation is going to impose only 1-2% of the cost of, say, a new house. But when you add all that up, when I go to whether it be the Air District or the Water Board or a city, soon all those individual regulatory requirements add up, and whether it be housing or several of the other industries, you end up with a significant cumulative regulatory impact that does often call into question economic viability. And so I suggest that we ought to think about how we can structurally think here in the Bay Area and statewide about how the cumulative impact of regulations on a particular industry or the economy of the state is having an impact. The other cumulative impact that I think we need to do a better job of thinking about is on policy. And here, the issue that I see over and over again is when we talk about implementing the goals of SB 375 and the sustainable community strategy that TED is going to be writing for us in the years to come, with a partnership, a genuine partnership. I'm giving you a hard time. But I ask the question often of regulatory agencies, what is this regulation going to do? What is the impact on our ability to implement the sustainable community strategy that gets adopted? And we had some discussion and a good dialogue about that earlier with Henry and Ted talking about the issue of, you know, the air districts need to protect health and analyze impacts of project residents in areas where there's a lot of diesel. And as Henry said, those happen to be the areas, in many instances, where policymakers are saying we need to redevelop and put a whole lot more people in those areas. So there's tension there. Ted talked about the need to, or the desirability, of moving many more of those 2 million people that are projected closer to the bay to take advantage of the more favorable climate, less need for air conditioning, for heating. Well, as we speak, we have another agency, BCDC, that is in the process of adopting Bay Plan amendments to address sea level rise. And there's a lot of talk, and there are some who want to retreat from the bay, pull up the drawbridge because of sea level rise. So we have these policies that are in tension sometimes unintentionally. And we haven't yet worked out an effective mechanism for really thoughtfully thinking it through. The joint policy committee that we have in the Bay Area, I think, can form the basis for a clearinghouse. That's a good place to start. I think it we all need to get together and think about how we can improve that structure. But I think it's necessary. Otherwise, we're all going to be, you know, acting in our own silos from a regulatory perspective and not thinking about how each particular regulation that is aimed at addressing greenhouse gas emissions might unintentionally undermine our overall strategy. And so far, I've talked only about the regional agencies. I see some city folks here. You've got a whole nother layer of regulation there, both in terms of fees that they impose, policies that they want to implement, and sometimes they're at odds with what the regional agencies are asking. So it's complicated. There's a real need, I think, to step back and give the same sort of analysis on jobs in the economy and recognizing interdependence and cumulative impacts that we have begun to do and do a pretty good job through CEQA on environmental analysis. So thank you very much.
Maybe it's, can people hear me? All right, great. We're running a little over, so what I would what I would suggest is that we'll go to the question answer portion of the program. But if people have questions for the first panel, they're here with Doug, and we can include them in this Q&A session as well as the panelists here with me. And I just have one to lead off, and I'll follow up on what you were just talking about, Paul. Paul, CEQA is an interesting statute in that it's in my judgment at least, not well-suited for looking at greenhouse gas issues and climate change issues, because it looks primarily, even when you look at cumulative impacts, it looks primarily at localized impacts, even if it's from multiple projects in an area. And I understand the Air Resources Board, the Air District, and local governments, county governments, are looking at guidelines to address greenhouse gas emissions in reviewing CEQA projects. But here's my question to you. It seems to me that somewhat counterintuitively, a lot of projects that will be reviewed under CEQA, although they may pose potential local impacts from emissions, they ultimately reduce greenhouse gas impacts by having, for example, a residential community in an infill area that reduces commute times and the vehicle emissions associated with commute traffic, by having a more local shopping center so people don't have to drive longer distances to get to whatever they need to purchase, and by having industrial facilities that serve the infrastructure needs of the local community without having to import those materials long distances by truck or otherwise with resulting emissions. So do you see in dealing with the people you deal with at the local regional and state level, do you see those kinds of advantages being taken into account, or an effort to take them into account in reviewing projects and developing guidelines?
There are some examples. I think it hasn't penetrated to the extent that I think it should and will need to. But I think the best example would be in SB 375 itself, where that statute, the state legislature recognized that if a project is consistent with the location, use, and density of the sustainable community strategy that is going to be developed, for example, for the Bay Area, the EIR for that project does not have to consider greenhouse gas emissions from cars and light trucks at all. It's basically a statutory exemption from GHG analysis for precisely the reasons you articulated. In theory, the region will have got together and decided on a land use pattern via the SCS if it's blessed by CARB, and it will, if implemented, achieve our region's GHG reduction goal. Therefore, it does not really make sense on a project-by-project basis for projects consistent with the SCS to subject them to individual CEQA review on greenhouse gas emissions. So I think that was, and as someone who worked on 375 and was involved in the negotiations, I can say that was extremely contentious and difficult to get people to move on that issue. That was not easy to get. And it's only about a paragraph in a very long statute, but it almost caused the entire legislation to blow up. But many people thought that, look, if you're not going to give that kind of relief and acknowledgement that if a project's consistent with this kind of plan, that CEQA has done its job and there's no need for this project-specific review, then we're not going to get anywhere. So I think that's the best example, and I think that getting that foot in the door, if you will, is important.
Thank you. Let me open it up to questions from the audience.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you're aware of any industry collaborations on existing work rather than new construction. I'm involved with the Cement Association. So is there has there been any effort on the part of industries to get, quote, credit for the offsets, if you will? So if your product, or in the case of housing, is particularly environmentally sensitive, you know, you provide all kinds of benefits in offsetting greenhouse gases. If your industry produces CO2, you know, is there a fair balance where you get credit for doing the right thing over time? Can we assume that industry can partner or collaborate to influence the policy?
I think industry is already trying to influence constructively the policies that are being put forth. One of the things that's interesting in looking at cap and trade, at least the form in which it's come out, I think something like 4% of allowable offsets, and that seems to me to be just a bit low. We're not talking about local warming here, and I think we all ought to keep that in mind. If we truly are trying to address, as a society and as Californians, global warming, then there ought to be great opportunities for industries, whether they're petroleum or cement or whatever, to invest outside their fence line, if you will, in other projects that can be monitored and checked and verified and that reduce greenhouse gas emissions somewhere else in the country, in the world, that isn't simply local. And I think it's a really important issue that everyone ought to keep in mind, and anyone who has an opportunity to participate in the public process ought to advance that commentary and make sure that our regulators hear it and take it to heart.
I just want to mention one other collaboration. There are many that are happening, but in the maritime industry, under the auspices of the International Association of Ports and Harbors, which was designated as part of the essentially the climate initiative organized by the Clinton Climate Initiative. There are working groups right now active that are joining together ports around the world to develop best management practices that are being posted on a website that the IEPH has. It's called the Toolbox for Air Quality, and it has two areas. One is criteria pollutants, and the other is greenhouse gases. So that's, I mean, that's not cap and trade, which is one of many solutions for operations, but this is really a toolbox that can provide ports around the world with solutions, engineering solutions, that they can implement right away.
This may be primarily for Scott and Lisa, but you were talking about the efficiency of transport by rail and transport by sea.
And I talked about housing.
Right. Right. The efficiency of home
building. Let the record reflect.
Okay, you can respond too, Paul. Question is, I guess, I realize, Lisa, with shipping, it's being dealt with a little bit differently because it's international regulatory, and they're looking at that from what you said about the Copenhagen Commission. But are you seeing in the effort to regulate your industries and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, are you seeing the efficiencies provided by these modes of transport being taken into account in whatever regulations or whatever schedule for regulations may be imposed? Is that getting traction with the legislators and the regulators?
Well, even before we started seeing regulations, we started seeing pressure from our customers, the large manufacturers. And there was a group with the Business for Social Responsibility, the Clean Cargo Working Group, and they were a group of large manufacturers, Walmart, IKEA, and they, in trying to reduce their carbon footprint, saw that transportation was a big part of that. And so they started asking the shippers to provide statistics based on carbon efficiency, and they use a parameter of kilograms carbon dioxide per TEU mile. And so Matson, along with a lot of other carriers, are starting to look at that. And that's also a parameter that's been incorporated into some of these indices at the IMO level.
You know, my answer to that is kind of centered around it's always, what have you done for me lately? Get no credit for what you have done. So to speak, particularly in the, you know, in the rail industry, the things I mentioned have happened in the last 20 years. Yet, there's Tier 3 locomotives in 2012, Tier 4 locomotives down, and so all the things we've done, whether it be with personal research and development, it's private research and development, everybody wants more, and it's like it totally ignored what you've spent the last 20 years and the billions you spent and the successes you've had and the decrease in emissions you had. You don't get any credit for that. You just go forward.
That's the baseline, right?
That's the baseline. And you're penalized. You're penalized for doing the right thing.
Other questions? Yes.
This is really a question for the prior panel, but I've heard that cars don't pollute, people do. So if my car is sitting in the driveway, it's not polluting except that it took energy and pollutants to build it in the first place. But what I haven't heard any discussion of is behavioral modification. What do we do about people and changing their behaviors and how they act in order to change greenhouse gas emissions or other environmental emissions? I'm interested in if primarily the first panel, I think, is doing anything along the lines of behavior modification.
From the air resources point of view, we obviously can't mandate personal behavior, but we sure do a lot of educating public. We work through trade associations. We work through homeowners associations, through schools, through every different kind of group to try and bring tools. We have a cool California website. People can go on and look and see what they can do individually, either as a business owner, a resident, a local government. We have a lot of tools that people can look at, and so we go out and promote those and try and encourage people to do things differently. We try and put it in the context of why it matters now. So those are things that we're doing.
We have an RFQ on the streets for a climate behavior campaign, because we believe that, in fact, driving behavior can have a significant impact. It's things like keeping your tires inflated, like avoiding jackrabbit starts and stops, getting those golf clubs out of your trunk. It all sounds trivial, but you add that stuff up in terms of cumulative impact, Paul, and you can make a big difference. And so we're going to actually pursue that.
I think personal choices are huge. We at the Air District for many years has had a Spare the Air campaign that's really focused on building public understanding and to make clean air choices. And probably most people out there know the term Spare the Air a lot better than the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. So that's really important. Actually at the break between the panels, I had a brief conversation with somebody that said, look, you know, all the land use stuff you guys were talking about is really great. The policymakers can issue this challenge. Local electeds can try and do the right things. Developers can try and take, you know, push the envelope a little bit. But until neighborhood groups, individual people support those land use changes, we're not going anywhere. And that's absolutely right. I mean, all the things that industry can do, that the regional agencies can do, that local officials can do, is important. But until there's public, individual understanding and support, we've got a really tall challenge.
I think we're out of time. Oh.
I wanted to. Hello?
Is it on?
Yeah. I wanted to get back to something that Paul Campos brought up, because it kind of ties the whole thing together. Since I had the privilege of working with the panelists for Sea Level as well, on the one hand, people are saying, you know, build on the bay because of the climate benefits. It's cooler, you don't have to heat the housing, we can concentrate the density there, and we can concentrate the transportation infrastructure and the shipping infrastructure there. Some of the folks on the sea level side are saying it's not a good idea to build along the shoreline. So how do we as a community and as thought leaders reconcile that issue? And so maybe since I know you're all really talking about how we collaborate. I wonder if someone wants to jump on that question, or whether I should just ask Paul to lead off a quick answer for that that one. And really, I think the regulatory agencies are probably wrestling with that question as well.
I think Ted's Joint Policy Committee is a good place to start. BCDC is a member, as is ABAG, who's going to be writing the Sustainable Community Strategy. And so my bottom line answer is that I think the regulated community, the stakeholder groups, and the regulators need to get together more often and discuss these things, and ultimately set some priorities, and there are going to have to be some hard decisions. Not every project is going to be perfect from a sea level rise perspective or a smart growth perspective. And, you know, we cannot have the perfect be the enemy of the good or the very good.
If I could add, close to the bay doesn't necessarily mean on the bay. And there's lots of opportunities to build on areas that will not be subject to significant sea level rise, at least over the next century. The other thing, of course, is we have already built very significant public and private infrastructure in areas that will be susceptible to flooding. The financial district of San Francisco is a very good example. We're going to have to protect those areas anyway. And if we're going to have to invest in protecting those areas, perhaps we should maximize the rate of return on that investment by, in fact, encouraging even more growth in those areas that we have to protect.
Thank you. I think that we're about out of time and we need to move on to the lunch program. I'd like to thank our panelists here on the stage, as well as the prior panel, for a great discussion of the issues. And lunch officially begins at 12:30. It'll be in the Jewett Ballroom, just downstairs, and there'll be the program for lunch begins at 1, but please make your way to the Jewett Ballroom at 12:30, and we'll proceed from there. Thank you again.